state by about 20,000 votes 4 years ago, and polls show him in a tight race with Trump this year. A Biden campaign official says Deb Haaland is planning to do more campaign stops around the U.S. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Quernbach.
Tribal leaders came to the Colorado Capitol recently for Ute Day, highlighting the Ute Mountain Ute and Southern Ute tribes. They called on lawmakers to follow through with promises made last year. KUNC's Lucas Brady Woods reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The tribe's leaders addressed a joint session of the legislature. They praised the state government's tribal engagement efforts, but said more needs to be done. Southern Ute Chairman Melvin J. Baker said the tribes have not been given equal access to sports betting, even though it was legalized statewide 4 years ago. He said tribal leaders met with Governor Jared Polis about this last year.
He assured us that one of the priorities would be to visit the tribe and to resolve this issue. Enough is enough. We are tired of broken promises.
Baker and Ute Mountain Ute Chairman Manuel Hart also called for more state support around health care, education, and water rights. I'm Lucas Brady Woods at the state capitol.
U.S. Senator Brian Schatz spoke on the Senate floor Tuesday to highlight $1.3 billion in federal funding for Native housing programs. It's part of a six-bill appropriations package signed into law last week.
The historic funding is a very, very big deal. It means that they can build more affordable housing, provide rental assistance, and get electricity and plumbing into their homes.
Schatz, who chairs the Indian Affairs Committee and Appropriations Subcommittee on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development, says there's also new federal funding for tribal transportation.
In England this week, Prince Harry says News Corporation owner Rupert Murdoch knew about criminal acts used by his media outlets to spy on celebrities for news coverage. That's according to attorney David Sherborn, who represents the prince and others, including actor Hugh Grant, in an ongoing suit against Murdoch. The claims were added to the prince's lawsuit against Murdoch in a hearing on Monday. A judge found last year that high-ranking executives at News Group newspapers knew public statements denying phone hacking, police bribery, and exercising improper influence in the pursuit of stories were untrue. Claims added to the lawsuit Monday read, quote, "It is inferred that they would not have been carrying out this extensive concealment and destruction strategy without the knowledge and approval of Rupert Murdoch," unquote. Prince Harry won the equivalent of $177,000 in December when a judge ruled that phone hacking was, quote, "widespread and habitual," unquote, at Mirror Group newspapers in the late 1990s, and that it continued for years while news executives covered it up. In April of last year, Murdoch settled for $1.7 billion in a defamation case brought against him by the Dominion Voting Systems Corporation. Murdoch's media outlet Fox News was found to have lied about the voting system during its presidential election coverage.
It's Wednesday, and that means a visit from KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, who wishes the news would let him stay in the present.
In Trump speak, bloodbath just means economics. And if gangs of maggots see it in a more visceral way, as long as you try to meet a debt, it's okay if you don't succeed, especially if you don't think you owe anybody anything. It's that strategy of accusing your rivals of doing what you're doing. Like saying if he lost, that might be the last election, which would be his plan if winning. Dictators don't want to run again, only run away when justice comes crashing in. I'm thinking Donnie can't win every time, but can he appeal, whine, and stall long enough? And maybe he won't win the election, then be unable to lead a rebellion because he's too indebted, court-involved, and probably already on his way to some country without an extradition treaty. I don't want to think about November. Just today, this week, hear people talking about flowers or March Madness, not the insane threats of politicians or America's slow march to undemocracy. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Lisa Loving, Reed Johnson, Doug McVeigh, Dan Raphael, and Birdie. The producer is myself, Lisa Loving, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Eric Galatis. Director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our great members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth and have a good night.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his newest article. It's called Reframing Power, Policing and Its Purpose, explored in PICA's Policing Justice exhibition. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. So your new piece dives into the Policing Justice exhibition at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, or PICA. What can you tell me about how this exhibition came together?
Yeah, this exhibition at PICA set out to consider the history of policing and its purpose today. I talked to the co-curators, Cleo Davis and Nina Amstutz, and you know, they said that they wanted to highlight how police have used violence as a tool to marginalize people locally and across the United States, but also look into how, you know, we can imagine a future without police.
So there are multiple aspects of this exhibition, and one of them are these shipping containers or time capsules. There's three of them. Can you walk me through those? What are they each communicating?
Yeah, the three time capsules, they're made out of shipping containers, and they're really cool. They sort of, each one represents a different century. So it kind of starts 1800s with the, you know, early Oregon settlers, and kind of tying the colonization of indigenous people here in Oregon with the black exclusion laws, and, you know, black people not being allowed to move to Oregon up until, you know, 1926. Those laws were on the books for 80 years. The second one kind of moves into the 1900s and the kind of next phase of that, which was a little less segregation and a lot more gentrification. Talks a little bit about like the kind of Albina district, which the Albina Vision Trust is now kind of taking over and trying to return to a black cultural hub. And then the third one kind of goes into, you know, this Afrofuturist kind of idea of, you know, the year 3024, 1,000 years from now, when, you know, kind of post-revolution, there's a whole new kind of, you know, what we might think of as sci-fi now, but, you know, a world where, you know, all kinds of things are happening. Plants are growing back and buildings look different, and the police are not oppressing people.
So in talking to the curators who helped to put this all together, what was kind of the point of view or some of the underlying themes about policing that they wanted to emphasize?
Yeah, there's a lot of different perspectives. I mean, I think of this, you know, story in Street Roots this week as kind of being, you know, a bit of a culture piece. So I think it is important to kind of say that people's different interpretations of this exhibition, you know, people should be allowed to kind of have their own interpretations of it. But what they were kind of talking about And they were clear with me about that. But they didn't want it to be too heavy-handed, but it is inspired out of Black Lives Matter protests and sort of the idea that police use violence and this kind of spectacular violence is something that, you know, media, TV stations kind of focus on. We see videos of that stuff a lot. But there are also ways that it sort of colonizes the mind, makes especially people of color, have to kind of live in fear of the police in a way that, you know, keeps kind of the, sort of protects the colony on one side and then, like, keeps people, the other people, sort of out of the colony. So there's kind of a lot of ways, different ways of thinking about this kind of mind, body, sort of spatial violence. Who has access to language? Education, things like that. So it's really pretty broad.
Well, you went to the exhibition. Can you set the scene for me? Like walking in, what are some of the things that you experienced?
The room is, you know, has these really high ceilings, and so there are a few things that are kind of hanging from the ceilings, and there's shadows kind of cast along these broad walls, these 10-foot wide walls that have other watercolor paintings on them. It's sort of centered around this mini theater that is built by Forensic Architecture, who has a couple of films that are showing in that mini theater, and then kind of on both sides of it has like a little bit more detail, so it sort of shows its work, I guess, by showing like documents about the 6,000 different use of force incidences that the Portland police reported during 2020 protests, and like how much tear gas was used in downtown on June 2nd, 2020, which is commonly known as Tear Gas Tuesday. And then there's these, Don't Shoot Portland has this really amazing exhibit that, you know, just an archive printout of their archives. It's just on these huge 20-foot tall walls and films playing and stuff. So there's really kind of a lot to see, and I think I spend a decent amount of time there just trying to write this story and talk with people and go to openings and stuff, and I still feel like I can go back and glean a little something else from it each time.
Well, like you mentioned, there are film screenings associated with the exhibit both at PICA in this physical space and then also at the Clinton Street Theater. What can you tell me about those?
Yeah, the curators were actually really clear. So there are some like short films that are happening, throughout this month and into April. The whole show runs into May. But there are, the curator said those things kind of aren't meant to be like extra. They're actually meant to be a part of the show. So it is worth kind of looking at the schedule and going over to Clinton Street Theater and seeing some of those things. There was a symposium a couple weeks ago where people were talking about their works and some of the other work that people are doing to impact the community here, you know, growing toward abolition of carceral systems. And then there are three works there that are film related, two from Forensic Architecture, one on the Tear Gas Tuesday, and one on the Normandale Park shooting of when June Knightley was murdered, and sort of exposing like some of the police narratives that were incorrect around that. And then the Chilean artist who's now in New York, Alfredo Yar, has one that's all about Trump using a helicopter to clear protesters at the Lafayette Square in D.C., which is sort of experiential, kind of wild, very visceral experience.
Can you talk a little bit more about the second of those Forensic Architecture films, The Murder of June Knightley?
Yeah, this came out. It's available online as well. It's also worth, you know, seeing in the way that they've set it up at PICA. But that film sort of highlights how demeaning language and just outright misinformation, sort of tried to discredit demonstrators before and before and after this attack. People here in Portland may remember this, that there was, it's the Justice for Patrick Kimmons march that was happening at Normandale Park, and a I guess a right-wing agitator, I guess it would be, came out and out through the dark and instigated an altercation with the Corkers, who were just the people there to keep people from traffic. They weren't protesters. They weren't armed. And he ended up shooting five people, killing one 6-year-old woman, June Knightley. And this is told, you know, Forensic Architecture makes these films that are, if you haven't seen them before, they're very deeply researched, and, you know, there's helmet cam footage. These are all, the experience is told by the people who were there corking, like, right there in that moment. These 911 calls, it's the sort of rebuilt kind of scenario of some of this is accurate down to the millimeter, and they're able to kind of pull all of these things together and really show, you know, with some real veracity, what actually happened that night, despite police narratives and Mayor Ted Wheeler's narrative that were false.
How would you characterize, like, what is the breakdown for the exhibit of things that are Portland specific and things that are broader?
Yeah, Portland was in a really interesting position then, as we all may remember, in the sense that, you know, Portland police went further with regard to tear gas than any other city in the United States. We had more use of force incidences than any other place, and our protests went on longer than any other place. And Trump only sent his, unmarked goons to this place. And so there is this sort of Portland-centric piece to it, but it didn't happen in a vacuum. And the kind of what led up to that and how we kind of move past that into, you know, a different future is very related to the United States and around the world. United States policing, I guess, is sort of unique in its own right. But yeah, I mean, you know, a good half or more is pretty Portland specific, and then the rest I think is specific to some other places, or is sort of another overarching thing that isn't necessarily connected so much to place.
Well, you were able to speak with the organizers and curators of Policing Justice. Why this exhibit now?
Yeah, Portland is in a really unique position right now. I think that one of the things that kind of keeps coming back into this through the symposium and through the conversations that I had with the curators and with the artists is the idea of rebuilding, you know, a day at a time, the world in a way that abolishes the police, whether or not police go away entirely or not. Isn't necessarily the point. Amstutz, one of the co-curators, was saying, you know, just simply keeping that as a goal in mind and starting to support the systems that can lead to better futures for younger people. You know, there's an exhibit about the education system in Portland and how people getting expelled from school can lead them into prison, and how supporting schools might be a great way to keep kids out of trouble and be able to imagine a better future. And, you know, just kind of engaging in those kinds of conversations around things like the Albina Vision Trust, which is taking back that neighborhood and that area that the Black community has been displaced from, and just creating a new kind of idea. I think there's some pretty wildly, you know, exciting ideas coming out of there and things that we haven't really seen before. It's a really creative process that the Albina Vision Trust is pushing on.
What do you hope that listeners and readers take away from this piece?
One of the things that goes missing when you talk about abolition of carceral systems is I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding about that the idea would be that you just simply, you know, send all the police officers home and say, okay, no more police now. But one of the things that I think the exhibition does really well is actually calls out the different ways that you can build a society built on justice that makes that unnecessary. It makes policing unnecessary. The purpose of the police is to keep certain people in line. you know, and sometimes uses violence as a tool for that. But there are ways that the world could just be built in a way where, you know, people are free to live in community.
If our listeners are interested in finding out more and reading your piece, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy it in print from a vendor. They're out in your neighborhood. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. You can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, thanks again for having me.
Thank you. That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest article. It's called Reframing Power, Policing and Its Purpose, explored in PICA's Policing Justice exhibition. More information is available online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm Lisa Loving. It's Women's Month, and we're talking with Jackie Gethner about her spring meet and greet for women of all ages. It's next Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m. in the Hollywood neighborhood at the Center for Responsive Aging. It's a network event with music, dancing, and pizza for anyone identifying as women to connect and plan ongoing fun things together. Jackie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell our listeners about yourself. What's your background and how did you come to this work?
So I am a licensed massage therapist and I've been one for 35 years. I do a myriad of kinds of massage with people, but I also teach classes and I train people around issues having to do with touch, especially around chronic illness and families and everybody who's so stressed out from living in today's world, basically. And when I started this work in the late 80s, I started working in the world of HIV and AIDS, and I did a lot of work with them, which resulted in my getting a national award from Kaiser in 2009, for my work. It was a National Diversity Award. And with the money that I was given, I set up a nonprofit for women over 50, believing that women were going into becoming elders with not a lot of support and resources for all the changes that we were going to go through. I say that also stating that I turned 74 this last week and a half ago. So I kind of knew what was going on, and because my focus had been in HIV and AIDS, it was very important for me to educate women, because we started my nonprofit on the day Viagra came out. And women are the fastest growing group of people getting HIV, but it's a very small group, so it doesn't get a lot of coverage. So I devoted myself to also just educating women about how to become more independent, how to realize that one day life was going to change, and it certainly has for people over the years. But one of the things that I keep encountering with not just my nonprofit, but all the things I do out in the community, is that two things. Number one, we have a number of women who are moving to Oregon to be closer to their children or other members of their family, and they're being really unsettled. You know, we kind of thrive on long-term relationships, and a lot of these people are moving from the other coast, they're moving from other states. And a lot of the feedback that I've gotten, and certainly this is not everyone, but a lot of feedback that I've gotten is that older women are not particularly friendly when they move to Portland. And I know everybody is probably going to say, oh, well, that's not me and my friends, but it does happen, and it happens quite a bit. And with the winter especially, people stay in more because it gets dark earlier and people are not comfortable being out unless they are driving or those kinds of things. So I decided with Amber Kearns Johnson, who is the executive director of the Center for Positive Aging, that we do an event. I'd hoped to do it earlier, like January or February, but that wasn't possible. So we're going to just do this event next Wednesday to encourage older women to come and get to meet each other, for younger women to come, because I've also found in working with younger women that there's a lot of women who don't have really good relationships with their own moms or an older female, for the myriad of reasons of which there are. And so they would like to have an older woman to just kind of check in with and ask those questions that we get asked. And so it's a meeting for both younger and older women. The other part of this is that, like I said before, women don't like going out at night because a lot of women don't drive anymore or don't feel comfortable driving at night as they did when they were younger. And so their excuse for not going out is, I don't have a way home. And so as part of this event, I've asked people who do drive to be willing to offer a ride to somebody else, so that we can make sure that everybody gets home. So the event will be from 5 to 7. It costs $5. We are going to be serving pizza. So for your $5, you get some pizza and you get a beverage. And we are going to be doing an activity that's just going to get women talking to each other. And at the end of it, we're going to see how many people have been able to, it's like a scavenger hunt, but of information. And when we're done with that, people that have gotten all those things filled out will be entered into a raffle for two copies of what I've put out called The Girlfriend Guide, which is a guide to getting older in many different ways, and also a gift certificate for massage from myself at a future date.
All right, if you just tuned in, we're talking with Jackie Gethner about her upcoming spring meet and greet for women and people identifying as women at the Center for Positive Aging in the Hollywood neighborhood. And we are going to give more details about how to show up there at the end. Jackie, what do you hope comes from this event?
Well, I'm hoping that we have a lot of fun. I have a woman who I really respect who is putting together a play tape for us so we can dance and kind of be comfortable in that respect. But I just would like women to feel comfortable to reach out to each other and say, hey, my name's Jackie. Where do you live? What do you like to do? How can we maybe connect in some way down the road? You know, especially if there's a younger, older woman, are there things that you're finding difficulty with because you don't drive? You said you don't drive. Is there any way that, you know, we can possibly see about maybe getting together once a week and I'd be able to take you for groceries or anything like that? And it might not be anything at all other than for women to get out and just meet other women with no other obligations, and just have a nice time.
Why do you want to see younger women and older women, and again, people who identify as women, why do you want to see the young and the older together?
Well, because I think it's kind of like, if you don't mind me saying so, it's kind of like our government right now. We have a lot of older people in there who feel like they've carried the torch and they have all the answers, but we don't, as older people, have all the answers. But we have a lot of answers because we have a lot of experiences, a lot of times based out of things that really weren't good things for us, but we've learned the lesson. And I'm a true believer that we all don't have to cycle through and all learn the same lessons. So I'm hoping that this will be an opportunity for younger women to hear older women's stories about how they came to be in the place that they are now, what they think they could have done differently, if anything, what they've done well, and what they've learned that they might like to share with a younger person. Younger people, and this is going to sound so funny, but younger people can certainly share how they look at things differently, but the reason I'm laughing is they can always share technical advice. There's so many older women who just are not social media advocates. They don't spend a lot of time maybe other than Facebook and possibly Instagram, but they don't know how to navigate those things easily or some of the other things that are required by today's society. So I found that younger people are very open to helping me figure out something on my phone or my computer when I can't get it done, and I'm hoping that that will be shared between other people that come to the event. You know, we're all different kinds of learners. Some of us can learn just by hearing from somebody and can then complete a task. I'm one of those people. I have to physically be shown how to do things. And then because of a head injury that I had a long time ago, I have to keep doing that in order for it to be entrenched in my brain so that I can repeat that pattern. Otherwise, I will forget and need to be re-educated on it. So for women to have, or anyone really that's older, to have somebody they can call for those kinds of questions, even if you don't do other things together, but that they're willing to share that information and support people that way, it's going to help us stay more independent. It's going to help us stay safer and be able to widen our horizons a bit more than if we aren't able to do those things.
So, Jackie Gethner, I want to bring this conversation back around to the event that's happening this coming Wednesday, March 27th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Center for Positive Aging. It's in the Hollywood neighborhood. It's more or less right across the street from the Hollywood Theater. And the event is from 5 to 7 p.m. It's going to be $5. There's going to be pizza, beverages. There's going to be conversation, maybe even a little bit of games. And the other thing is, if you need a ride home, there's going to be people at the event to help. But the transportation is not available to people using wheelchairs. But the event itself is ADA accessible. So, Jackie, right. I also wanted to say, contact the Community Center for Positive Aging for questions, 503-288-8303. And the location at the Center for Positive Aging is 1820 Northeast 40th, 97212. Jackie Gethner, thank you so much for being with us.
I would just like to say we're going to be dancing. So please come prepared to dance. It's not a dress-up event. It's just come as you are. Be who you are and just enjoy yourself. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Great. Thanks again, Jackie. For KBOO, I'm Lisa Loving.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.